Another early Hollywood project of Orson's before he made Citizen Kane was The Smiler with a Knife, a comedy thriller based on a novel by Nicholas Blake.
You said you would do Smiler with a Knife for nothing if you could do the Conrad.
No, no, that's not what I said. Say, Conrad, we couldn't get the extra 50,000, and I said if they'd put up the extra 50,000, I'd do Smiler with a Knife free. In other words, it was a 50, no, because they wouldn't agree on Lucille Ball, who they said was too old for a leading part.
We talked about
yeah, that's right.
Too old then.
Yeah, that's right. And no good and a B actress and all that. You can imagine how idiotic they were. Because she was a stock actress then. They didn't know what they had.
Does she know this story?
I never told it to her, I don't think. We're very good friends. I never, you know, I don't like to embarrass people with that kind of story, saying that they didn't want you, you know. I suppose I could, because she's so successful now, it would be a pleasure to her to hear.
We talked about this before, but we didn't get it on tape, so I'd like to have it, which is that you never even saw the film that's supposed to have influenced the style of the construction of the picture, which was Preston Sturges' script,
no.
The Power and the Glory.
No, I didn't. And I've heard that it has strong similarities. It was one of those coincidences.
It does.
I'm a great fan of Sturges's, and I'm grateful I didn't. He never accused me of it.
He didn't?
No, we were great chums, but if it's true, I just never saw it. I saw any of his comedies. I don't know when it was made or
he didn't
who
direct
made it.
He wrote it. Directed by William K. Howard in 1933, and it was with Spencer Tracy.
I never saw it.
And it isn't really similar, because it isn't the idea of Kane of seeing the same scene.
Anyway, I never
saw it. It's not there at all, but there is a sort of a flashback structure.
Anyway, I never saw it.
Yeah.
But I would be honored to lift anything from Sturges, because I'm very high admiration for him. Mm.
And you were friendly with him, too.
Very. We're very, very good friends. Mm. Right up to the end of his life. From the moment I came, before Hollywood, I knew him before I went to Hollywood.
In New York?
Yes.
As a stage, yes.
In fact, I met him first when I was going to school at Todd, about 13 years old. He was a wonderful fellow, and I think a great filmmaker, as
great.
It turned out.
Yes, a great filmmaker, and yeah. A great screenwriter.
Yeah.
Great writer, anyway.
Yeah.
Great dialogue.
Started in the hospital after, you know the story, how he became a writer. He'd been a businessman till he was about 40. And he got very sick and lay in the hospital and decided to write a play and wrote Strictly Dishonorable, which ran 8 years or something,
yeah,
you know.
Incredible.
And that made him a writer, and then later he became a director. Never thought of it before.
Incredible. And what happened to him in Europe? Why did he...
What happened to him in Europe? He was,
or nothing happened.
No, he was just trying to raise money for a picture. Nobody would give him a job. That's as simple as that.
There's that story about Ford when the producer... I told you that, didn't I? When the producer came down on the set and Ford stopped shooting and... he used to do this all the time. He'd stop shooting and sit down and start talking to the producer. Just sit down and start talking. And the producer noticed that everybody else sort of stopped working. And after a while, he said, well, don't you think you ought to, you know, go back to work, Jack? I mean, he said, oh, no. Gee, that would be rude. I mean, if I came into your office and you'd stop making phone calls, wouldn't you, and do whatever you do? You wouldn't keep making phone calls and talking to people while I was in your office. You'd sit and talk to me, wouldn't you? Well, I'm just doing the same.
Great.
Yeah. Well, I heard that you once told the cast to play baseball.
Yes, we did, but that was a big practical joke. That wasn't to be rude. That was intended as a practical joke and was friendly. That was when Schaefer came with all the bankers from New York, and they'd all heard the, you know, crazy wells, and we thought it'd be nice if they came and found us hard at work, so we were all out playing baseball, you know.
Oh, I see.
Yeah.
And did it go over as a joke?
It went over as a joke, yes, it wasn't. It was quite benevolent.
Oh. Well, that's good. Because I was always, you know, believing in omens. I was rather, I thought it was, you started shooting Citizen Kane the day I was born, a year after the day I was born.
Oh, shut up.
Well, nothing wrong with that.
Yes,
we've been talking about that people get...
That's the day you were born, it seems to me.
People get... You said people get better as they get older, so don't...
As they get older, not as they ripen.
A 15-week schedule, which is supposedly how you shot Kane, is very short, actually, compared to today's standards. Was it short then?
Yeah, and it wasn't dialogue. That included all the trick shots and everything else.
Mm. And the cost was low, too.
Yeah.
I mean, compared to what pictures cost.
And compared to then, because it was so many trick shots. It was a big fake, the whole picture, you know, where very little was built.
Yeah.
It's full of hanging miniatures and glass shots and everything. It was very little construction.
Did you purposely work for economy in making the picture?
Of course. I wanted to go on working in Hollywood, you know.
Yeah.
I'd spent a year in Hollywood before I made it, and I'd found out how important economy was. More important in those days than now.
Mm.
Because grosses weren't this big, you know.
Yeah. Now, could you talk, you want to talk a little bit about the Hearst intervention and the Luella Parsons business and all that?
Well, you're sure he didn't really intervene. They intervened in his behalf. And of course, it began very badly because Luella had been on the set and had loved it and had written a wonderful article about this picture I was making, Never Guessing. And it was Hedda Hopper, her enemy, who blew the whistle on it. Now imagine what happened. When the opposition press found out what the picture was. So that really raised the roof, you know. And after that, it was all the hatchet men in this enormous, in those days, enormous Hearst empire who were after me more than Hearst. He might have got around to it, he didn't need to, you know, but they were all after me to show the boss that they were on the ball. And it scared Hollywood to death. They were ready to burn the film or anything, you know.
But wasn't Hedda supposedly your friend?
Yes, but what a break for her as a newspaper woman. She had to print that, you know. Couldn't blame her. Imagine what that did to Luella and, you know.
Now, truthfully, did you expect a reaction like that from Hearst while you were making the film? Or did you not feel it was that close that he would connect it?
I expected it.
You did.
Hearst's gripe, and it was a real one, was what was done to Marion, which was very unjust, because she was an extraordinary woman, and nothing like the woman in the movie.
But and you didn't do that to be Marion.
No, but that's the way it got in people's minds, you see.
Yeah.
And he was, if he was upset, he would have been right to be upset on that count, I always felt.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because Marion Davies was supposed to have been quite a great comedian, according
to... Not only that, but she pawned all her jewels for him when he was broke, you know.
Mm.
Everything. She stayed by him. She was an extraordinary girl, in a way.
Mm.
You know?
And not at all like...
Not at all, no, nothing. That was the libel. Kane was better than Hearst, and his second wife, that people equated with Marion, wrongly, because there's no comparison. It, as I say, it's more the McCormick style. Was unfair.
You're awfully funny, aren't you?
Yeah.
I love that line.
The following discussion is about Dorothy Cumingore, the actress in Citizen Kane who played Susan Alexander Kane, the character loosely based on Marion Davies.
She was a great actress, wasn't she? Or was it really a...
Yeah, she was a discovery of Chaplin's, you know.
Yeah, but what picture? Or didn't he...
Never. He just discovered her and didn't use her.
And you picked her, took her over?
Yeah, after testing a lot of strippers, I tested about 10 strip girls.
Yeah.
There were none of them any good.
You wanted that kind of...
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Cheapness.
Yeah.
And had she ever acted before?
I don't think so.
Mm.
And she was such a success in it. Everybody said she was so wonderful that she turned down every offer she got for 3 years. And then there were no more offers, you know. That was the end of it. She was waiting for another part like that.
Was she an intelligent actress?
Yeah. Of course, her old thing was tremendously tricked, you know. We blew dangerous drugs in her eyes and sprayed her throat so she couldn't talk and everything, you know. She
was...
To do all that, but she was still great, you know. It's, what do you know? It's morning already, you know. My favorite moment.
You know who she reminds me of? It's quite an uncanny because Judy Holliday didn't exist yet, but she reminds me so much of that character.
Who began with her in my theater, you know, Judy.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, she was 2 years in the Mercury.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, then maybe she saw that performance.
No, I don't think so. It's just that's the but there is a...
Well, there's a mark.
Yes, very much, yeah. She didn't have the humor or the richness of Judy, but she had a... There's a great big similarity.
Yeah, and the voice at that point, in that line that you just said, there's almost...
Yeah.
Yeah, she gave a great performance.
But I tested a lot of people for the part, and almost all strippers, as I remember them, burlesque girls.
She was rather fragile, actually.
Yeah.
And did she sing her own things?
No.
You had to get a singer to make it sound
that's
bad.
Right. That was a big work. Very well done by the girl. Worked a long time on that.
And had Bernard Herrmann worked with you in the...
In the radio for many years. Mm-hmm. Many, many years. He was intimate member of the family. I think his score was marvelous, though, for his opera of Salambo. It was a marvelous pastiche.
Yes, it was made up for the picture, wasn't it?
Yes.
It was no such...
No, of course not. It's a wonderful opera score, I think.
Great.
Yes.
Yeah.
The joke we're discussing here, which Orson said was partially invented by the prop man, has to do with a shot during the opera sequence in which the camera travels up, up, up into the flies to reveal two stagehands watching while Susan Alexander sings her aria. They look at each other, and one of them holds his nose.
And that shot that you told me about was invented by the prop man?
The idea for it, the way it ended, we were going to go up to them, and the idea, he contributed, that's really the fact. But he certainly did contribute. His name was Red.
And you were just going to go up to them, but...
Yes, looking disgusted, and their reaction... I don't know what. Anyway, he was a big contribution.
Were you really going to buy Kane from RKO?
I tried to.
And that was your idea, to buy it and show it in tents?
No, I wanted RKO to do that. And then when they wouldn't, I was willing to, or anything, because I could have made a fortune on it.
Yeah.
They'd only sold it to me. They would have got out from under. I would have been independently wealthy for the rest of my life. Everybody would have been happy. And they wouldn't do it. And I could have raised the money easily to buy it.
Was it then, do you think, because of Hearst that the picture didn't really do the business that it should have?
It did all the business that it should have in the theaters it played in, where it did capacity business. It played in no chains in no major theaters.
So, in other words, it didn't get the exposure.
It didn't get the exposure, but wherever it played, it did tremendous business.
But it couldn't get...
Not in England, where it was a disaster.
Mm.
Not in Italy, but in America, it did very well wherever it was shown.
And
because of my radio.
Yes. And it couldn't get the bookings because of...
Nobody would give it to them. They were scared. No, nobody would put it in.
So you had reckoned with Hearst's anger, but you hadn't realized how effective it would have been.
Yes, of course not. And I always thought that, a little courageous showmanship could have turned it to good account.
Which you were
right. Indeed, I was right.
Yeah.
And I didn't conceal anything. Everybody had seen the script and knew what it was. It was no...
I mean, if you kept it a secret and just...
Yes, RKO had read the script and, you know, they went ahead and put up the money for it, they then should have been willing to go. Theoretically, although I have no criticism of Schaefer, that's the basic situation.
Yeah.
Nothing was slipped over on them.
And did Luce really offer to help you buy it?
No.
That's not true.
If he had, there would have been no trouble.
And there was also some...
But he would have bought it. I'm sure he loved it.
If you'd asked
him. Anybody would have. Everybody was willing to buy in on it.
And they were also going to somebody... There was some talk about reshooting some scenes, wasn't there? That
no, not that I ever heard of.
Not for you to reshoot, but...
No, I never heard any of it. Only to burn it.
And what was the something, an attack on a play you'd written, His Honor the Mayor?
Well, that was later. That was communist thing, you know.
Yeah, but it was again by Hearst, wasn't
it? Yeah, but that Hearst did all kinds of things like that. Mm. That was the well-known American communist, you know, Orson Welles department.
Can you describe with any kind of brevity how... because I don't want to go into it in great detail, because it's be boring for you, but how physically the script of Kane was worked on? Was it, I mean, in other words, were there sessions where you just sat around and talked, or did you write certain scenes and Mankiewicz wrote certain scenes?
There were sessions where I worked with Mankiewicz at the beginning. Then he went away to the desert and wrote his script, and I stayed in Hollywood and wrote mine.
Having decided to work on different scenes or both the same script?
Script.
Yes.
And I got his script and I used what I wanted and used what of mine I liked without really talking with him much.
Uh-huh. And that was it?
That was it.
And well, you said that Hausman contributed somewhat.
Yes, because he was out in the desert with Mankiewicz.
Oh, I see.
As I understood it and Mankiewicz, who was needed help and was enormously talented fellow, but his own worst enemy. I'm sure that Hausman is largely responsible for getting from Mankiewicz his great contribution.
Hmm.
Not only as a producer, but even as a writer, I'm sure that Hausman deserves real credit for that part of it.
In those days when you were working with the talking...
But we didn't work together because I had trouble talking to Hausman or anything. It's not Mankiewicz.
Yes, yes.
Mankiewicz was an old friend of mine that I knew long before Hausman knew him.
I see. And you chose him to work on...
No, he'd been writing some radio for me.
Oh, I see. So you...
Yeah, and he also worked on Smiler with a Knife.
I didn't know that. But the whole discussion of the construction of the script in terms of the flash, intricate flashback thing was worked out with you and him?
Not worked out. We had two versions of it. We talked theoretically about it together, and he went out to the desert and worked out his, and I stayed in Hollywood and worked out mine.
Mm-hmm.
After theoretical, general discussions.
Mm-hmm. The change of point of view,
was lost a lot, but that was my basic idea for the whole movie.
Mm. Well, it still has a lot to do.
Yes, but not as much as I intended it. It withered away to a great extent from what was originally intended, because I wanted the man to seem like a very different man, depending who told it, and it remained that he was ambiguous rather than totally different. As the script turned out.
Yeah, that's true. In other words, it really was more to have been more like Rashomon.
Yes.
But I think Kane is much more complex the way it
that's
is.
That's right. That's why it worked out that way. But the original thing was more of a gimmick.
Yeah.
And the Rosebud gimmick was Mankiewicz's, and the Rashomon gimmick was mine.
Mm.
And the Rosebud thing remained because it was the only way to get out of it at the end.
Mm-hmm.
And mine withered away, but my actual development of the scenes and of the character was much more sympathetic than his.
Mm-hmm.
His was much more an attack on Hearst. It was much more bitter.
Yeah. Well, there's no black and white in the picture. That's what's good about it. And that, in fact, that's in none of your pictures.
No.
All your heavies have...
Yeah, that's right.
You told me once, and we didn't get it on tape, that the breakfast scene, the famous breakfast scene.
It's stolen from The Long Christmas Dinner of Thornton Wilder.
Mm.
And the minute I shot it, that evening I called up Thornton and told him I'd stolen. I just got the idea because it wasn't in the script originally.
Oh.
And I got the idea, and I realized as I was shooting it that I'd unconsciously stolen it from them.
And what is it? I don't know the play. What is it?
It's a one-act play, which is a long Christmas dinner, which takes 60 years of a family's life.
All at dinner.
And they all sitting at dinner, and they get old, and then people wheel baby carriages by, and coffins and everything, and... You know, the idea that they never leave the table and life goes on was the idea of this one-act play. And I realized, I did the breakfast scene thinking I'd invented it. When I was almost finished with it, I suddenly realized that I'd stolen it from Thornton, and I called him up and admitted to it.
And what was his reaction?
He was very pleased.
He's still a friend, a good friend.
Yes.
He's a good writer.
Yeah, I think so. Wonderful. I haven't seen him in a long time, but his newest novel, I think, is marvelous.
The Eighth Day?
Yeah.
I hear it's very good.
I think marvelous.
But now, a scene like that, when you say you made it up on the set, literally, it came to you on the set and you wrote
it. Well, it was going to be a breakfast scene, and there were going to be several breakfast scenes.
And
you can see how it would have been written as a script.
Yeah.
Many scenes with transitions.
Yeah.
And my idea was simply to photograph it as a continuous breakfast without dissolves or anything. Mm-hmm. Having done that, I suddenly thought, that comes from something. That's Thornton's.
Yeah, well, there is a connection between them, which is a sort of a flash pan, a sort of whip back and forth.
Instead of dissolving or something, you know.
And the conversation actually
was
written
before, yes, that's right. That's right. Some of it was written before, most of it was invented on the set or two or three days before during rehearsal.
Why did you want to do the projection room scene in darkness?
Well, how else would it be if it's in a projection room? Oh, because most of the actors play up same parts later on. They're all doubling. We didn't have anybody else to play them.
Is it true that Alan Ladd's in there somewhere?
Not in that one. He's in Xanadu at the end. He's the leading character.
Oh, really?
He's the one that does all the talking at the end. You can tell he's got his hat the way he wore for 20 pictures afterwards. You can't miss him if you look.
He's not the reporter, Thompson.
No.
But he's
the
other one.
The leading reporter when all of them gather at Xanadu. And you cannot miss him. It's his first movie part.
Mm.
And there he is with the hat to where he wore it for 20 pictures.
How did you find him?
He was brought by his agent, who was later his wife, and read for me, and I thought he was very good.
Had a good voice.
Yeah, and very effective and intelligent, and there he was.
Mm.
He's one of the only people that I didn't know was in the picture, you know, new people. Very few, three or four people in this one.
And so the projection room scene was mostly the people that were used later.
Yes, doubling.
Uh-huh.
The man over here, everybody's doubling except the head fellow. Everybody's playing, you know.
Yeah.
We didn't dare turn on the lights, so you'd see it's the same actor.
It's also damn dramatic.
Well, you know, so of course it's all right. You know, I've got a big excuse with that light coming and all that. But basically, it was the first scene I shot in the movie.
It was?
Yeah. And I didn't want to show all these. In case it was good, I wanted to save it. And I didn't want to hire a lot of actors if it wasn't good. So I used the old Mercury cast that all turned up in other parts later on,
and
heavily disguised by darkness.
And you also shot it in a real projection room, didn't you?
It was all shot in a real projection room. It was because we didn't want to ask. I was supposed to be just testing.
Yeah. You didn't want to...
Yeah. Alert anybody to the fact that we were shooting.
Yeah. Marvelous.
And there they all are. If you look carefully, you can see them. They all turn up later on in other parts. Everybody in the movie's in it.
Yeah. Not you, I hope.
Yes, I'm there.
Really?
Yeah.
True story that when Pearl Harbor was announced, nobody believed it because...
True. I'm dead right, yeah. Particularly since I had a patriotic broadcast that morning and was interrupted in the middle of it. I was on the full network reading from Walt Whitman about how beautiful America was. Then they said, Pearl Harbor's attack, and doesn't that sound like me trying to do it again? They interrupted the show to say it had been attacked Sunday night.
We've got to put that...
Roosevelt sent me a wire about it.
Saying?
You know, I've forgotten what, I don't have it. Something like, you know, and the crying wolf and all, you know, that kind of... Not the same day, he was too busy, but it was about 10 days later.
I asked Orson if the director, Irving Reese, who later became a film director as well, had directed the radio production of Hamlet.
Did Irving Reese, in fact, direct you in the radio Hamlet?
Yeah.
And the radio Macbeth?
Yeah, I think so. One of them or both, yeah.
Both, yeah. But who did the adaptations?
I did.
On both.
We got one cue wrong in Hamlet. We got one cue off with Bernard Herrmann. He had broken his baton, thrown his script up in the air, and walked out of the studio 40 seconds before airtime because of a quarrel with Irving Reese. And I dragged him back. And we didn't have time to get the notes back in order on his stand. So he was one cue off all through it. So we had fanfares where it was supposed to be quiet, spook music, and so on. It was riotous. It was just exactly one cue off the whole show. Approaching menace when it was supposed to be gay party and, you know, all that. Alive, you see, nothing to do. He just went on. Got funnier and funnier. Because Reese was an emotional type director, and Benny is an emotional type conductor. And between the two of them,